economic policy uncertainty has gone up a lot, and trade policy uncertainty has gone up even more. And that economic policy uncertainty is kind of at COVID-type levels.
Amidst increasing trade tensions and global uncertainty, central banks around the world are committed to their mandates and creating financial environments that are conducive to business. Zooming into South Africa, we are a relatively small emerging market that is especially vulnerable to the global environment and exogenous shocks. In 2000, we were one of the early adopters of inflation targeting, a regime that has proved to maintain price stability in volatile environments and show resilience to the external shocks. 25 years later, as global uncertainty grows, what is working and what isn't working with this monetary policy regime? What can we learn from other countries, and what can other countries learn from us? At the end of March this year, the South African Reserve Bank hosted its biennial conference, which explored the notion of inflation targeting as a global monetary standard, and how the future of inflation targeting looks. Alongside our policy paper series, assessing various policies in South Africa from 1994 till now, we have arranged to sit down with Dr. Chris Lowalt, the head of research and member of the Monetary Policy Committee at the South African Reserve Bank, to learn more about how monetary policy has evolved since 1994. Earlier this week, Chris also delivered the Monetary Policy Review, which contextualized South Africa's current position, bearing in mind the recent developments such as the VAT increase, as well as the geopolitical tensions. It also included several scenarios allowing people to form expectations accordingly. Welcome to USS Podcast Series. I'm your host, Margot G, and it is a pleasure to introduce Dr. Chris Lowalt to our show. Welcome, Chris. It's an honor to have you with us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Right, Chris, so you have had a career in public policy for a long time and been very good at it. When you were a student, did you know what you wanted to study and which career path to follow?
Well, I've been in public policy for too long, I think, is the first thing to say. Did I know what I wanted to study? Yeah, I was pretty clear as a teenager that I had a strong interest in really just current events, and I was reading the newspaper and reading The Economist magazine from as early as I could. You know, I'm not sure I was very clear about the direction I wanted to take until I was in university. In the US, you study lots of different things in a liberal arts college, which I went to.
Okay.
So I did both economics and political science and history and philosophy and all of that sort of thing, and chose to focus on economics really after university. Yeah, so there were different kinds of career options that I thought a lot about, you know, going into law, going into a political consulting type field. I chose ultimately to work in public policy, and in particular in economic policy, eventually. Obviously, as part of specializing, you've got to choose something. So that was what I chose.
Yeah. And when did you come to South Africa?
Well, I started coming in 1993 because I had a South African girlfriend as far back as that. And I kind of moved here in 1997, I think, more or less full time. I was still living part-time in Washington and finishing at that point a PhD. And eventually I met a bunch of people who were trying to put the Department of Finance back together again and build up its capacity. And I spoke to them and they offered me a position. So that was in kind of early 1998. And then I joined the National Treasury in October of 1998 and spent 13 years there before moving to the Reserve Bank.
Well, we're all very pleased that you got lured into South Africa.
I've enjoyed it.
Wonderful. It's a beautiful country. So, Chris, I remember the last time we had you on our podcast was also shortly after a monetary policy review. And it was at the time when the economy was facing much uncertainty due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Once again, as you said in the NPR this week, this world is a complicated place at the moment. How does the current uncertainty we face compare to that of the pandemic?
Good question. Well, it's really quite different in nature. So the pandemic obviously was a health and physical threat to the world, which had because of its nature had a wide range of very large economic implications. The current environment is quite different, just because the shock that we're seeing is really, it's not out of the blue. It's the culmination of various kinds of tensions that have been evident in the world economy for quite a long time. So, you know, there's been the growth of macroeconomic imbalances and skewed patterns of current account surpluses and deficits around the world for a long time. I suppose what's a little bit different in more recent years is that there's been a greater focus on the policy drivers of these imbalances and a desire for some countries to do more about it. Again, it's not kind of something that just one woke up and had this happen. It's been a discussion that's been going on out there for a long time. It's the current shock is obviously being caused by a kind of honing in on, well, what do you do about these kinds of imbalances and what kind of policy adjustments might countries want to pursue to rectify these imbalances? So that's, I think, kind of the nature of what we're at. In the NPR presentation the other day, I showed a slide that just showed that economic policy uncertainty has gone up a lot and trade policy uncertainty has gone up even more. And that economic policy uncertainty is kind of at COVID type levels. So we're kind of in the same ballpark of how much uncertainty is being created by the, you know, changes in view and policy shocks that we're seeing. And that kind of uncertainty is what really causes, in a sense, the damage, because you don't quite know what the policy response ought to be if you're a particular economy and country. You don't really know what the economic effects are actually going to look like. Is this going to hit growth? Is it going to hit inflation? Which one comes first? Which one dominates? And so all those kinds of questions are really important for how countries think about, well, what do I do next? Or how central banks think about, what do we do next? And if you really can't answer those questions because you don't have enough information or things aren't clear enough, then it creates this kind of uncertainty. And that spills over into what households and firms do. So they, what they did during the COVID pandemic, they stop spending, they stop investing, they kind of sit tight. And that's obviously carries through almost immediately into lower economic activity and starts to cause economic damage. So they're, you know, similar in their kind of medium term or downstream effects, if you will, even if the nature of the shocks and where they come from are quite different.
Okay. And when you say the policy uncertainty, apart from the trade policy, which policies would fit into that category?
Policy uncertainty. Well, so, you know, I mean, obviously there's a set of trade tensions out there in the world, and there are steps that are being taken or seem to be being taken by countries to change policies in ways that create more uncertainty, right?
Yeah.
So that's the kind of external shock. When you sit in a central bank or a ministry of finance, I suppose, in a particular country, you have to then look at, well, what are the implications of those external shocks? How are they going to impact on us? And is there anything we can or should do in response to that? You referred earlier to the scenarios that we have worked on as part of our monetary policy considerations. Those scenarios have various kinds of assumptions that we start from, and then we trace how those assumptions work their way through our models and how we think about the impact. So you usually start with a kind of partial equilibrium sort of shock, and then you work it through your models, which help you develop a general equilibrium perspective. As you would know, in a partial equilibrium shock, there always seems like there are very clear policy responses that you might think about. But once you get into a general equilibrium analysis, you realize that there are more moving parts and there are things that will, on their own, in an autonomous way, will respond to those shocks. And that modifies how you think about, well, what kind of policy would you want to put in place? I'll give you a very good example of this from the COVID shock, because it was one that I was quite interested in at the time. When COVID hit, there was an immediate sort of reaction that said, oh, well, we as the central bank should provide a backstop for, with the Treasury, backstop for corporates that wanted to, that should be extending loans to companies even though the shock is hitting. And that makes a lot of sense. The interesting part of it was that the banking system, in a way, had already internalized that and endogenously were already acting in that way. So they had already gone out to their corporate clients and said, we are going to offer you this kind of lending facility. They went to their small business clients and offered similar kinds of things, repayment holidays and all kinds of things without government or the central bank really having to do anything. The corporate, the banking system already reacted in the kinds of ways that you would want it to.
Okay.
And then if you kind of think about that in more macroeconomic terms, you know, if there's an external shock, often if your exchange rate will react, and that exchange rate reaction is an economically consistent reaction to the shock that's hitting you, and it kind of moderates and ameliorates the effect so that you don't necessarily have to respond as aggressively with policy if you were trying, if you decided you wanted to do that. So it, these kinds of endogenous responses to a shock happen at all kinds of levels and impact on how you think about the kinds of policies you want to, or you think you need to put in place or adjust in response.
Okay, and this makes me think of something Prof. Claudio Borio was speaking about during the biennial conference. He was talking about the behavioral definition of price stability being an environment in which inflation does not materially influence people's behavior, such that inflation expectations could become irrelevant. This is specifically if inflation is at a low level. What are the self-stabilizing properties of such an environment?
So what's really nice about that kind of level of inflation that he was referring to, you know, where it sort of doesn't impact on decisions made by households and firms, is that it kind of builds in an inertia into the level, right? So if the level is sort of expected to be, or the rate of inflation is expected to be, say, 2 or 3%, and households don't think about it when other prices move, then they don't take steps to react to those other prices moving. And that then you don't have those second and third round effects. So again, a good example of this is, you know, under an inflation targeting framework, you have a floating exchange rate. And a lot of the credibility of the inflation target derives from the understanding that if the exchange rate moves up and down, there won't necessarily be a response by the central bank or by other economic agents, and that prices, once that shock filters through, price, the inflation will go back to where it was before. And so firms and households don't react to that initial price shock by saying, oh, I need to get back to a certain level of real income or real profit margin for a firm, and so I don't react by raising the prices that I have. So what's really important in monetary policy and in any good monetary policy framework is that those kind of second round effects, third round effects don't happen or are very muted in the event of the initial shock. So I think that's a really, really important thing. But it requires economic agents to be conscious of that and not react to it. Now, the difference between a 2 or 3% inflation rate and a 5-6% inflation rate is that when you're in the latter category, you get more volatility in inflation. Mm-hmm. And this is, you know, something that we see all the time in the data. Higher inflation begets higher inflation, right? Because economic agents are reacting to these substantial movements in prices and their impact on their real income levels. But when it's at 2%, then there's very little reaction and people understand that the system will go back to a 2% inflation rate and they don't need to react. So it's a pretty critical thing. And it really, trying to get to that point has a lot to do with how you think about the monetary policy framework and what you want to adjust to get to that point.
Yes.
So credibility matters a lot.
Yes, definitely makes sense. And South Africa adopted inflation targeting in 2000, where we set the target between 3 and 6%. Based on what you're saying, the difference between 3% and 6%, the higher end being a lot more volatile, how did we come up with that specific target?
The 3 to 6%. Well, you know, this is ancient history now. But, you know, back then, inflation rates were higher. And South Africa at that time, this is the late 1990s, was sitting at an inflation rate that was sort of running around, well, I think it was sort of running between 8 and 14%. So there were shocks that were hitting that would drive it up to something like 14, and then it would ease back down to sort of 8, 9%. So that was clearly out of line with the rest of the world at that point. So we had higher inflation rate than we wanted. But inflation, broadly speaking, was only kind of at 2, 3% in advanced economies. For most emerging markets, inflation was somewhere around sort of 6, 7%. So we were at the kind of upper end of where we wanted to be, and we understood that we wanted to get lower. Now, you know, one of the basic principles, I suppose, of macroeconomics is that when your price level is rising faster than that of your trading partners, you're always losing competitiveness. So your real exchange rate is actually appreciating. It's rising over time. And that means that your trade deficit is likely to be more in deficit. Your nominal exchange rate will become more volatile, and that will feed back through into higher inflation rates. And then there are compositional changes in the economy. So consumers will start to buy more imported goods. You'll start to struggle to compete in your domestic and export markets with the competitiveness of the goods that you're producing because your inflation rate's just higher than in the rest of the world. So it makes a lot of sense in a very basic way to want to have your inflation rate near that of your main trading partners. And South Africa, of course, always had, because of the diverse nature of the economy, it has trading partners that are both advanced economies and trading partners that are more emerging markets. And so one of the questions that we grappled with back then was, okay, you're facing a world of different inflation rates. What would be a sensible inflation target for South Africa that, you know, was within shooting distance, if you will, of advanced economies, but was also kind of pegged around emerging markets or what was consistent with emerging market inflation at that time? And then also one that gave a structural kind of flexibility to the monetary authorities to stay within their inflation target, but have some room to maneuver. So 3 to 6% was kind of the band that was chosen. And it was initially meant to narrow over the next couple of years as the central bank adjusted its way of doing things, became more transparent, and built up credibility in that process. And then you could narrow the inflation target band down. And I think that the next year was meant to be 3 to 5, and then the year after that, I think it was 2 to 4 or something like that. But at that time, we had the Argentine crisis, you had the Russian crisis, and the authorities decided that they would keep it at 3 to 6% and leave it like that for quite some time. And it was never really revisited until sort of in the wake of the global financial crisis around 2013, 2014, 2015, we started to relook at this because essentially the central bank had the view that policy was appropriate. But what was clear from inflation outcomes is that inflation was sitting pegged at right around 6%. So we were at the top end of the target. And that made us wonder, well, what have we got wrong analytically? Is there something wrong with our model? If we wanted to lower the inflation rate below 6%, how would you kind of think about doing that? And that generated a series of analytical exercises that looked at the size of the output gap. So were interest rates consistent with a more accurate view of the size of the output gap? And then also, what would be a more credible inflation rate? So, you know, if you're always sitting around 6%, and the 6% is the high end of the target, then there's always uncertainty about, well, what are you going to do next? So if inflation is 5.5%, you're within the target, but there's always this risk that you're going to go higher. And so that kind of consideration seemed to play a pretty big role in the way the markets were interpreting what the Reserve Bank at the time was doing. And with the analytical improvements to our measurement of output gap, it changed what our Taylor rule was telling us was the right level of interest rates. And so we started to go in the direction of saying, okay, well, we have 3 to 6%. We really ought to be aiming for the midpoint of that target to get away from the 6% upper end, create more certainty on both sides of 4.5%. And that was, I think, quite successful, but it also generated a next step in that discussion, which was, if 4.5% is okay, what would be better? And then we got back into saying, okay, well, the average emerging market's at 3%. We are still losing competitiveness. Our interest rates are still higher than they ought to be. We're still paying an inflation premium on the distribution of income in the economy. So in other words, with an average inflation rate of, say, 4.5%, low-income households were almost always paying an inflation rate that was much higher, and they were losing income. So there were distributional implications of continuing to have an inflation rate that was higher. And so all of those things fed into a kind of renewed discussion about, okay, well, how would we lower this down to something that looked more like 3%? Sorry, long answer, but complicated.
Yeah. No, of course. And it's very topical because our inflation rate is now sitting, I think it's at 3.2%. And if we look at the competitiveness of our economy from a structural perspective, it is faced with issues, especially in the manufacturing sector. And what is the role of monetary policy to factor in this competitive buffer? Does it make sense to lower the optimal target to 2%? Would the range then be between 1% and 3%? What would a new inflation target look like?
Right. So the bank's mandate is set out in the Constitution, and it's about balanced and sustainable growth. So it's price stability in the interest of balanced and sustainable growth. And so, you know, there are different ways of thinking about how you might define balanced and sustainable growth. But I think one of them certainly is that you should have an inflation rate that's consistent with all sectors of the economy being able to grow. For some sectors, that means that they should be competitive. They shouldn't have a cost of production rising too much. For other sectors that are more dependent on interest rates and borrowing, you would want interest rates to be low and consistent with a level of borrowing that generates a growth rate that is sustainable over time. In a macroeconomic sense, you always think about these things as terms of macroeconomic imbalances or balances. So you don't change the inflation target to hit any one of these things. You want everything to be as favorable for growth as possible, right? And so you want low interest rates, which are consistent with lower inflation rate. you want more stability in the exchange rate. You don't want your price level rising much faster than that in the rest of the world, because that will impact on your competitiveness, et cetera, et cetera. So, I mean, there are various dimensions to what is a sustainable growth rate and the role that's played by monetary policy. And you wouldn't really choose one particular sector or whatever variable and sort of say, oh, well, we want to impact on that. You know, it's accepted in macroeconomics that low inflation over long periods of time in particular is most consistent with sustainable growth rates. And so that's what you kind of, aim for.
Okay.
So let me start by saying that. And then, you know, so where should we go? Well, you know, it's quite clear that 3% or something like around 3% is more consistent with the emerging market averages. Part of the point of the conference was to provide a lot of different insights into the way in which different countries around the world and regions around the world, as well as South Africans, think about what is a sensible inflation rate. And I think the conference was really unambiguous about some key points. I mean, one was just simply that the inflation rate ought to be somewhere around 2 to 3%. That should be what the target should be aimed for. There were quite a lot of discussion about sacrifice ratios, and on balance, the conclusions were that these sacrifice ratios, as measured for South Africa in particular, are very low, and so shouldn't really play a big role in how you think about the benefits of getting to a lower inflation rate. And that's simply, you know, just parenthetically, I mean, that's very simply this, you know, there's always some sort of short-term trade-off. When you set that against the long-term benefits are much, much larger. And there are ways of thinking about how you implement policy or implement a change in target that would reduce any short-term trade-offs quite a lot. I mean, so some of the work that we've done, and hopefully we'll publish quite soon, shows how if you have high credibility and you get almost an immediate reaction in the exchange rate channel, which is important for a small open economy, any kind of trade-off disappears pretty much immediately. And that was backed up by many of the speakers at the conference. There was quite a lot of discussion about the fiscal implications of lowering the target. Again, something that we've heard a lot about as saying, well, there are risks involved. Again, we had a very nice private sector panel that I chaired that we talked quite a lot about that. And the panel was pretty unanimous that those fiscal risks were much lower than people tended to think about them being. So I think that those were important takeaways. There were some contributors to the conference who worried a little bit more about, you know, rigidities and how monetary policy needs to react to negative trade and supply shocks. But again, those are really important points and things that we're aware of, but they don't really stand in the way of the general message here, which was that a lower inflation target would be a good idea for the South African economy.
Yeah, it was a very informative conference, and we'll definitely put the links on the landing page on the OSA website so people can watch them in full. It was great, and definitely credibility came up as a very important feature. And one of the strengths of inflation targeting is that it helps with that. And I think part of that is because it has a wide range. So I would imagine that if we were to have a lower target, we would still keep a large range. Would that make sense for the credibility, or am I thinking about this in the wrong way?
Well, I would think about it differently. Well, the point is just simply this, is that the 3 to 6% band target demonstrated that all else equal, you're likely to end up at the top end of the range, right? And so then your economy is suffering an efficiency loss in a monetary policy perspective. And so it makes a lot more sense to go for something that looks more like a more credible target that is a point, because it's just by definition more credible for the central bank to say we're aiming for a point rather than the target. But let me one last quick point about that is just that, you know, even if you say, well, our target is now 3%, it's understood that you're going to miss the target, right?
Okay.
The beauty, if you will, of inflation targeting is that it requires the central bank to be as transparent as possible about why it's hitting or missing the target. So if your target is 3% and your inflation rate comes out at 3.7%, you know, you need to explain to the public why that's the case and what you're going to do about getting it back down to the level. So the fact that you miss isn't a disaster. It's the disaster comes if you don't bother to explain why you've missed it.
Yeah.
And that's really, really, really important. That's really where credibility comes from and why we talk endlessly at the Saab about transparency. Why we've taken big steps in, certainly in my tenure there, to improve our transparency, to publish everything we do, to do model reviews and error forecasts, analysis, and put these out publicly through things like the NPR. The governor speaks about a lot of this stuff regularly, and we talk to investors and the public a lot about that, because it's critical to getting that right.
Yeah, communication, and we have definitely noticed it. I remember even in your NPR talking about how the forecast for inflation was it 4%, and it came in at about 3%, and there was a 1% discrepancy, and how so many people got it wrong, but there were good reasons as to why that was the case. It's very difficult being able to predict the future, especially with the amount of uncertainty that we have. Tell us more about the monetary policy review.
So I mean, this is, you know, obviously what we talked about in the NPR quite a lot. So, you know, we've had a good run of disinflation over the course of 2024. Inflation kind of peaked at the end of 2022 and then came down gradually in 2023. And then there were some upside surprises and shocks to inflation. And 2024, we started the year with inflation on the high side, kind of around 5.5%, and some upside surprises there on the monthly basis. And then as the year progressed, we started to see much, much better inflation numbers. And that's helped to bring inflation down in recent months to, you know, around 3%, which is great. And it's allowed monetary policy to ease quite substantially and to move back down towards the long run neutral level that we estimate to be at around 7.25%. So we've been able to cut three times, and that's obviously been important for the economy. Going forward, the inflation forecast is expected to rise back up to the midpoint, so around 4.5%. And that's great, but the MPC has become increasingly worried, of course, about the way in which global uncertainty, tariff shocks, and other kinds of shocks, say, feeding through into the exchange rate could upset that very kind of benign forecast trajectory. And that's why the MPC has become more cautious in the last couple meetings as we watch these developments and analyze them, and also put them into scenarios which generated some sense of what upside risk actually looked like for the inflation rate. And so we've talked a lot in the MPC about those kinds of new risks, or I should say heightened risks to the inflation forecast. And that's kind of where we are now, right? We've got a low inflation rate. It's going back up to a level that we're comfortable with. But there are these upside risks that we have to obviously pay very, very close attention to over the coming months.
Yes. And would you say we have room to maneuver during these uncertain times?
You know what? I'm not really. I mean, I think we've taken advantage of the room we've had, you know, to cut by those 75 basis points. I mean, there are, you know, so the uncertainty cuts in various ways, right? So the kinds of shocks that we're seeing could generate much weaker growth in the global economy, which would be disinflationary in the first instance. But the nature of the shocks coming through trade channels implies that eventually that will push up prices. So you might get a disinflationary GDP shock in the near term, and then as the near term changes into the medium term, that starts to become an upside inflation shock as prices go up. But we don't know enough yet about what the level of those tariff adjustments will be, what the responses by other countries might look like, how long they last for, how high, et cetera. So, the base case uncertainty is about a GDP shock and then a tariff shock, and that pushes you into more stagflationary kind of conditions where you have weak growth and higher inflation. How that plays itself out, how long that lasts is really where there's tons of uncertainty. And when there's so much uncertainty like that, in many respects, it makes sense for central banks to sit back and say, okay, now we are in data-dependent mode. Our confidence in our own medium-term forecast starts to weaken, not because there's anything inherently wrong with the forecast or the baseline, but because there are so many potential shocks that have a high probability of happening, that and you don't know how they're going to play themselves out. So you don't really want to react to those. You don't want to add more. You don't want to change things that will add more uncertainty to the outlook. You'd rather stay set and put where you are, wait to see what the data looks like, what the shocks actually look like in reality, before you start to take further steps.
Definitely. And I'd like to ask you another question. What challenges would you say lie ahead for monetary policy and inflation targeting in South Africa?
lots. I mean, we've, as the Monetary Policy Committee, we've always tried to, I think, do two things. One is focus in very directly on the particular factors driving inflation that we face and what that means for us from a monetary policy perspective. But we've also noted from time to time other things going on in the economy which don't have very direct impacts on inflation but have indirect impacts on inflation and which matter. And so, in that grouping of factors are things like weak growth, low productivity growth, investment rates, things that drive up long-term bond yields like public debt and the fiscal position, things like administered prices, which are sort of regulated prices that are not responding directly to market forces and therefore are kind of indirect, somewhat more indirect, the affected by monetary policy, things like that, which are more structural in nature or reflect different kinds of policy choices. And we've always felt it's quite important to be able to make, in a soft kind of way, the point that these getting some of these things right would be beneficial also for monetary policy. So, for a long time, wage growth is very strong and it drives up unit labor costs. So there's something in the labor market that's generating more inflation and driving up, therefore, interest rates in a way that we think could be solved differently. There are fiscal pressures. So if you're running fiscal deficits year after year and the public debt level is rising, that on its own generates indirect inflationary pressures and risk premium, which feed through into the exchange rate and which then turn into price pressures. We've seen a lot of that kind of thing in recent times, not just in South Africa, in other countries as well. But all of those things impact on monetary policy in important ways. And I think it's important for us to be able to talk about them and refer to them and put them in context relative to the much more limited tools that we as a central bank actually have to deal with the inflation rate that we've got.
Definitely. And on that note, I'd like to ask, what lessons have we learned over the past 25 years? What lessons do you think we could pass on to other countries considering adopting this regime?
Well, so many countries have adopted something like inflation targeting nowadays. You know, the countries that don't do it tend to fall into, one of two camps. I mean, one group it would be very large advanced economies that are relatively closed, although even those have now moved in the direction of having explicit inflation targets. I mean, the U.S. is a great example of that. China has had an inflation target for a long time. Europe has an inflation target, which they've had for a long time as well. So, you know, those countries have moved away or in that direction, those regions. And then there are very small economies that, because of their trade relationships with very large economies near them, choose to have fixed exchange rate systems, because any price shock happening in, say, the EU will have an impact on Swiss prices. And so what they worry a lot more about is the level of the exchange rate. They may also have inflation targets, although for economies that aren't as dominated by their trade with very large neighbors, having a floating exchange rate makes more sense. So I think in some ways South Africa was a bit of a leader in setting an example for other good-sized emerging markets that they could move to an inflation target and allow for a much more floating exchange rate, and that would not generate bad outcomes. I mean, it's, again, a little bit difficult. The other, I suppose, differentiator between South Africa and some other emerging markets is that South Africa is less dependent on hard currency financing for its economy. So when we borrow from abroad, we're still borrowing overwhelmingly in rand. And there are some emerging markets where they have to borrow in dollars, or more of their borrowing is in dollars. Their local currency markets aren't as developed. And so for them, having a purely floating exchange rate can generate costs from time to time. So you can think about the literature in recent years from Helene Ray and Geeta Gopinath and Pierre Olivier Gurincius. These are all people who have, academics who have worked on that subset of countries and trying to understand the dilemmas they face when the dollar strengthens or declines and what impact that has on their own exchange rates and their economy.
Thank you, Chris. Is there anything else you would like to add?
All good.
Good.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you, Chris. It is always a pleasure having you on our podcast. You managed to pull out the essence of what matters most in even the most complex of systems. Thank you also to our listeners. If you'd like to learn more about this topic, please see the related content on this podcast landing page on our OS website. And if you haven't yet, please subscribe to our socials on LinkedIn and Twitter. This is your host, Margot G. from the OS Podcast Series. Till next time.